Welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is Jamie Quiner, author of The Wandering Mind, What Medieval Monks Tell Us About Distraction. Jamie is a professor of history at the University of Georgia. She received her PhD in history from Princeton University in 2011, and she joined the history faculty at the University of Georgia in 2012. Her research focuses on Europe and the Mediterranean in the early Middle Ages, from political elites to pigs. Now you have to explain from political elites to pigs in the Middle Ages, because I think I saw when researching your background that you wrote a book about pigs in the Middle Ages. So that's please right. Explain that before we get into The Wandering Mind.
The pig book came about because when I was doing work on my first book, which is about politics and religion in the early Middle Ages, pigs sort of cropped up in documents where I really didn't expect them. And the more that I dug around, the more it was clear there was just like a ton of really cool material about livestock, about environment, about agriculture in the early Middle Ages. So I put that on the back burner while I was finishing book one, and then put it front and center in book two.
All right. So The Wandering Mind. Now, distraction is something that a lot of us talk about. It. When I saw your book, when I got the email from W.W. Norton, I said, for personal reasons, I wanted to interview you, because I think we all look around us with the advent of social media and all the things that are going on. We find it difficult to concentrate without being distracted. But I'm going to ask you to personally answer, have you had any challenges with distraction?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's just part of being human. It's just, you know, there's a ton going on. The world that you inhabit is going to be interrupted and, interfered with all the time for good and bad reasons. I, like everyone else, found this changing when I got a smartphone. It got harder. But I don't know. I also had a clarinet professor in college who had given me a lot of guidance about how to focus in the practice room if you only had a finite amount of time to really concentrate on what you were working on with music. So I also, had learned from him that there are ways to deal with it. And so when I, came across monks writing about similar issues 1500 years ago, it seemed like a cool opportunity to have a conversation with our current problem.
Now, you cover the time period, late antiquity to the Middle Ages. And so when we talk about late antiquity, we're thinking around the 300s all the way up to, I believe, the 800s. That's more or less the time period you're covering.
Yeah.
So what was it about that period that seems to have produced an abundance of material about monks struggling to focus and to concentrate? Because frankly, most of us, when we think about monks, we just think about monks we've seen in pop culture, cloistered, quiet, no problem focusing. But what you bring out in the book is that there's an incredible amount of material about monks struggling with focus and concentration. And you write, distraction originally and quasi-genetically was the result of humanity's initial separation from God, and that distraction was tied to the fall of Adam and Eve. And that's not your words, by the way. That's just your, I guess, your paraphrasing of what monks thought. So talk a little bit about this initial separation from God and the religious perspective on distraction.
Yeah, monks had different theories for where distraction came from. I mean, the sort of short-term answer was the answers that we often give today. They knew that people were busy. They had multiple social obligations. There was a lot of interests. It was hard to choose what to concentrate on. But they also looked at sort of the deeper explanation. And one of their main lines of thinking was that, it was endemic to the condition of being a person that was part of a larger world that was constantly in motion. So basically, since either since the very beginning of creation itself, just when the world became, you know, full of multiplicities and flux, that's when distraction starts, because you can't keep it all in mind at once. Or other monks thought it was after creation, when, you know, after Adam and Eve sinned and creation fell into, you know, it fell, it either became more chaotic or went into decline, or however you want to characterize that change. Then distraction was part of that sort of punishment, in the same way that like agriculture or childbirth or something was. Part of the reason that they were trying to figure out where distraction came from is that, you know, Christian monasticism was new in these centuries. And as more men and women became monks, they were really excited by the potential to say, we're devoting our entire lives, all of our energy to concentrating on God. Now we can finally, you know, be single-minded in the way that, you know, other people only hoped or dreamed about. But when they actually made that switch, they found they were still getting distracted all the time. And that prompted them to start wondering, well, where does this come from? It's not enough to just say that you want to concentrate. Clearly, we've made all these major life changes, and that's still not adequate. So where does this come from, and how do we deal with it?
Now, Christian monasticism, when I think about monks, we all think of all the monks together in one place. But what you make clear in the book is there was domestic monasticism. There was itinerant monasticism, that a lot of women were basically monks from home. And there were a lot of people during that time period who wrote about it and were very critical of it. So give us sort of the three main ways that people were participating in monasticism.
Yeah, I guess it would be hard to pick three. They were very experimental. But yeah, I guess, you know, sort of one main mode, and this is the one we think of most, is communal monasticism. Sometimes it is called cenobitic monasticism. And that's where monks live together in a community, in a shared space, usually with like dorm rooms, something like that. And it's predicated on this idea that you can really learn from each other and benefit from collective spirit as a community. Another popular form in late antiquity was what's sometimes called eremitic monasticism. It's being a monk on your own in isolation. And the monks who chose that option thought that actually, in contrast to communal monasticism, you were likely to be better at concentrating all by yourself, because your, you know, fellow monks weren't around to annoy you or bother you or complain about how bored they were, that kind of thing. Another popular option was domestic monasticism, where you didn't abandon your hometown. You didn't necessarily even leave the house that you grew up in. You just decided that you were going to reprioritize how you spent your day and your time, and in some cases your money, so that instead of, you know, climbing the career ladder, trying to gain honors or elite status or run a business or whatever, you were going to have a life of concentrating on God, and just sort of operate differently in the home that you had.
So monks said that there were dire consequences from distraction, that really became a pervasive motif, you write, among Christian monks in late antiquity and the early Middle Ages. And Basil of Caesarea, who worked as a bishop in a Roman imperial province, told his monks, you write, distraction was at play whenever someone was not trying to please God. So he seems to be pointing out distraction as a sin.
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky. I think they probably didn't see it exactly as a sin or as something evil, but that it had consequences that could be catastrophic for your soul. So it's not like it was good, but because it was something that you basically could never fully escape, it wasn't exactly a sin or evil. It was more just something that you had to work really hard to combat all of the time, because it could because the idea of being pulled away from the things that mattered just meant that you could become ethically lazy or out of shape. So it was a way of insisting that you needed to kind of watch yourself all the time to ensure that you weren't just sort of sliding into not paying attention without even really realizing it.
And Bass also talked about deliberate goal setting as another kind of warm-up. I was a little surprised to see that, the goal setting.
Yeah, that's one of the most basic ways that monks thought they could stay focused, which was to be conscious and conscientious about what it was you were trying to accomplish. Because if you wouldn't even realize you got distracted if you didn't have a destination that you were trying to get to. And so they said this as a way of being kind of helpful. Like, you know, if you feel like you've gone off course, just remind yourself of where you're trying to go. Because monks just like us could kind of get caught up in the heat of the moment and forget what it was that actually mattered to them.
I was listening to a podcast by a pop culture figure and writer named Touré, and he was interviewing Zadie Smith, the great novelist who at one point was a professor at Columbia University. I think they moved back to England, her and her husband and their children. And at one point, they're talking about their writing schedules, and she's talking about how she writes from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., but no internet, no phone, nothing. He's a writer also. He talks about writing, and then he talks about getting off a schedule because something will come up in the writing, and then he has to go research it. So he's on the internet looking up things, and Zadie Smith is telling him, you should just take a note and keep going, not allow yourself to go down that path, because going down that path may add 2 or 3 hours once you go down the rabbit hole to what you're doing, as opposed to just write a note and keep going. What do you think of that?
I love writers discussing their schedules. There's something that is very monastic about it. Monks also disagreed in the same ways that they did about what the best working method is. Like, some really advocated this meditational style that was basically like going down a bunch of rabbit holes, where you start with a key concept, but the more that you think about it and pull together all of these different associations and memories and knowledge sets, the like bigger your understanding of the concept is. In some ways, it's like research or analysis, really thinking through a problem expansively. But then other monks would say, they side with Zadie Smith, I think, and say, well, no, you just need to, you know, have a much more narrow sense of what it is that you need to be concentrating on, because otherwise it starts to become difficult to differentiate between distraction and wide-ranging thinking.
And you also delve into nonstop critical thinking. I think you refer to it as discernment, if I didn't get that quite right. I can remember having these discussions with a close friend of mine who's very religious, and one of the terms he would often use is discernment. So talk a little bit about that concept and discernment, and how does that work in trying to battle distraction?
Discernment was a technique that monks used. It's basically watching your thoughts enter your mind. I guess I shouldn't even say your thoughts. They didn't always identify with them. It's watching thoughts enter your mind and decide whether they're worth keeping or worth getting rid of, like shooing away. And it's a lot analysis now. Like, you can't determine automatically if something is good or bad. You have to say, well, is it encouraging me to do something that, based on what I already know, is not good? Is the time and place appropriate? Does it seem to be motivated by, you know, impulses that are bad? Like, is it my greed that's sort of telling me or originating this thought? And often you needed to even consult other people to determine whether this thought was good or bad, whether you needed to jettison it or keep it. And the idea was that as you watched your thoughts do this, the ones that you decided were bad, you would either tell to go away or just say, I'm not going to deal with you. And that had the effect of kind of neutralizing them or even just sort of making them wither away because you weren't going to invest in it. Whereas the good thoughts you'd hold on to and keep thinking about them and helping them grow. And you know, another advantage of it, as far as monks saw it, was that identifying thoughts as good or bad was a way also of depersonalizing it. You didn't have to get upset if bad thoughts came into your mind and say, oh, I'm just thinking all these bad thoughts. You could just see them as kind of external to you and you could detach from it.
Makes me think of Norman Vincent Peale, The Power of Positive Thinking. Do you think a lot of the, and I don't know if you read the self-help books or how familiar with the self-help books, but I'm wondering how much of what the monks are talking about or some of the concepts that are being promoted in some of these self-help books that focus on the power of positive thinking.
I think what they have in common is that monks were pretty optimistic that, you know, your mind was something that you could train and exercise just like any other part of you, that, you know, you really could learn to start thinking in different ways and using this capacity that you had in a higher functioning form. But I think they're different than a lot of self-help books in that they also saw that a lot of solutions or strategies for dealing with distraction were not rooted in your individual self. That distraction was also something that was a product of your environment. It was a product of how you related to other people. So the solutions also needed to be in part, not just, you know, self-help, but sort of communal help and systemic help so that, you know, deciding to opt into, you know, the world of honors and money making versus opting out, the relying on other people to support you both emotionally and physically, thinking about how the way that you interacted with culture affected your mind. I don't think you see that stuff in self-help much now, thinking about sort of the larger forces beyond you. And I think it can be a little bit, for monks, it was somewhat liberating to realize that, you know, if they didn't succeed in fixing themselves the way they wanted to right away, it wasn't just because their will wasn't there. It was for these other larger reasons too.
I've been reading a novel recently, or I'll confess, I've been listening to a book where the protagonist is actually a Buddhist. And I think one of the things you talk about in the book, and you're going to have to help me here, but it caught my attention where there are some concepts that the Buddhists actually use that they actually picked up from medieval monks.
Well, we don't really know, actually, to what extent Christian monasticism was interacting with other monastic traditions. But we do know from other historians who've worked on this that early Buddhist monks, the same time as these early Christian monks were having these debates, also did think about distraction and think about the role that, say, meditation or visions had. But it ends up looking really different. So, like, Christians become really interested in visions for what they tell you about how your current behavior has ramifications for the afterlife. And as a result, they start thinking that contemplating your death is a really good way to motivate yourself to pay attention to God. Whereas in the Buddhist monastic traditions, visions are often a kind of diagnostic for telling you what your current spiritual state is like. So it's more like confirmatory or diagnostic is probably the best word for it. It's just revealing how your current state of mind, what that says about you.
Now, you divide the book up into the world, different chapters, the world, community, body, books, memory, and mind. And you write in the chapter about body that the monk's goal was an elusive synthesis of body and mind that could elevate them above the world of distractions. And you also write that above all, it was hunger, not sex, that monks combated most doggedly in their struggle for self-control? Not sex, but hunger.
Yeah, I think if you were to sort of just ask people what sort of sacrifices or things monks gave up that we all know about, I think probably the first answer we would give now is, yeah, they're celibate. But monks in late antiquity and the early Middle Ages, for them, giving up sex was a little bit more elementary. And the harder thing was to manage their appetite, their hunger. And that's partly because, you know, you're supposed to eat every day. It's the most frequent and constant reminder that you have these parts of yourself that just sort of seem to think without you even intending it. Like your body will just want things and be drawn to things without you even deciding that that's what's appropriate. And so they saw eating as a kind of opportunity to train the body to be more disciplined, because they thought, not unlike some people today, they thought that body discipline was also good for their, how they thought, for their mental well-being. The flip side is that to train your body, you also had to train your mind. So fasting and just having a regimented diet meant you also had to get yourself in the right mindset to be sure that your body would follow the rules. So it's this back and forth that they were constantly wrangling with. Like, how do you have this ideal balance so that the mind is high functioning, and the body doesn't get in the way?
I want to go to the mind, because there was a word in that chapter that you used that I had never heard of. Can you guess the word?
No.
Metacognition.
Oh.
Awareness and understanding of one's own thought processes. And I love that word meta. I see it all the time in literature and things. And to think about thinking is an interesting concept. So talk a little bit about that.
Monks really like to harness metacognition as one of the most refined techniques for managing distraction. At its most basic, they would just watch themselves thinking. This is something they were trained to do since they were little monks, which is just, a mentor or a teacher would just say, "What are you thinking about right now?" And the monk would say, and over time got habituated to just sort of watching how the mind worked. And over time developing some interventions to sort of nudge it in the right direction. And it might mean watching your thoughts for a while and then deciding they needed to go in another direction. It might mean being more proactive at the outset and saying, "All right, what was I thinking about today? Where did my mind go? How would I like to change it?" So that's partly related to goal setting too. Sometimes they tried to do more like, they'd imagine themselves in these sort of metaphorical or hypothetical situations where they'd sort of pretend like, "Okay, as I'm praying, I'm going to imagine that, you know, God is a judge or a politician or an emperor or a parent, someone who I really do want to be at my utmost concentration when I'm talking to, for either because I, you know, there's impending litigation, or because I'm in trouble, or because I want to make a good impression." And then they could, there was more complex forms. Discernment is a metacognitive move for sure. Practicing, higher and higher stages of prayer where you are watching your mind sort of move from, you know, the material that you're reading to having a kind of conversation with God. But eventually they hoped that if, you know, they were doing all of this stuff well, eventually that metacognitive movement would stop completely, that the mind would, instead of both thinking and thinking about thinking, it would become absorbed in what it was doing, that it didn't need to be monitored at all. It would just move exactly where it wanted to be. And then, you know, at the highest level, it would come to a complete stop because it was just sort of in the presence of God and didn't need to be actively stretching out anymore. It was just there. But those moments only lasted briefly before the mind started moving again. They knew that they couldn't attain some sort of permanent state of total concentration.
I think there's an appropriate sports story related to that. It's thinking about a basketball player, and I'm a big basketball fan, when they will say they were in the zone and they score 50, 60, 70 points. Kobe Bryant scoring 81 points, where you're just, everything's just dropping. And they've always described it as they're not thinking about what they're doing. They're just doing, and it's just coming almost organically. It's just coming. It's just coming, and it's just coming. They also talk about when we, you know, when you read about basketball players, you know, how they'll shoot 100 free throws, shoot 500 jump shots. They'll do all these things, this training, this preparation, so that when they get into the game mode, it comes naturally without thinking. And I think there's some sort of crossover way that this also works when you're trying to deal with distraction. How can you train your mind to deal with distraction? What are the different things? And it looks like, just reading through your stories, that the monks thought deeply about how to train themselves to deal with distraction. But as you exhibit, they had different opinions all over the place. Matter of fact, they tell stories of monks who are all by themselves. They've decided that they can reach their highest potential being by themselves, but they became so famous that they're constantly being interrupted. They can't be by themselves because people are coming by, asking them questions. So that doesn't really work out. But there is a story here that you tell about monks around the Red Sea in the Persian Gulf, and the story of a desert father who used two baskets to keep track of his thoughts every day. I want you to finish that story.
Yeah, that's a really good one. He had a basket where that was labeled bad, and a basket that was labeled good. And every time he had a thought, he would put a rock in one or the other basket if it was a good or bad thought. And if at the end of the day he had more bad rocks than good rocks, he wouldn't eat. But if he had more good rocks than bad, then yes, he could have his meal. And I think that story was popular because it was extremely unusual. I don't think most monks would have said this as normal behavior. If you try to imagine yourself actually committing for an entire day to dropping rocks in thought baskets, I mean, even for a monk, that's a lot. But they were impressed by that kind of dedication, because that's what they all were striving for in one way or another, even if they didn't have a pile of rocks to work with.
During that time, Peter, I imagine that there was more of an oral tradition, and there were incredible amount of stories being captured and shared with each other. But also you talk about hagiography, and these were stories about saints. And apparently during that time period, there must be a lot of documents you were able to locate, because you are quoting so many different monks, from Augustine, which, of course, you know, St. Augustine, you know, a lot of folks are familiar with him, to John Cassian, Pacomius, who demons were trying to distract. Now, that's another great story, who kept it going. So these monks shared all these stories to sort of just keep themselves motivated. And you talk about, let's see here, this is what you write. They figured that carefully studying the achievements of prior generations would help them improve themselves, including their concentration. That is one important reason why monks were avid readers, and why it is possible to find common threads of experience in a world as diverse and argumentative as theirs. But I want to go to the other monk, how do you pronounce it?
Pacomius,
who didn't allow a bunch of demons to distract him. Please tell that story.
Pacomius was a really influential founder of monasteries in Egypt. And he, like many sort of monks who were remembered as saints, had a lot of stories that circulated about him after he died. And many of about him had to do with how intense he was at concentrating. He often got visited by demons who were really intent on trying to make him falter. And they resorted to stuff that I am sure were that monks at the time also thought were comical stories. The demons would try to do things to make Pachomius laugh, including like sort of parading in front of him with like different costumes and outfits on. There's one that I really love where they basically are acting like construction workers trying to move this big boulder past him, but they don't actually have a boulder or any tools. So they're just miming it out. So they're like huffing and puffing, like, oh, we're pulling this really heavy thing. So, you know, I think hagiography also often has these like joke or comic elements in it too, because they, you know, it's another reason that monks enjoy the story so much. And you can still laugh at them and realize that the punchline is still genuine, which is that Pachomius was extremely good, even in these hilarious situations, at doing what he wanted to do, which was pray.
John Cassian, you quote quite a bit in your book, and you write that he was frustrated that even when he was singing or praying or reading, the contents of his memory still managed to distract him. And you also talk about in that chapter the danger of a hyperactive memory. Provide some context to that.
Well, yeah. Cassian's text, the collationes, or the conferences is how it's usually translated, is a really amazing psychologically exploratory examination of how it's like a deep dive into the mind and how its mechanics can interfere with or help you be a better monk. And one of, you know, sort of deep into the text, he and his friend Germanus are having a conversation with a respected monastic mentor, and they've learned a lot about the mind so far. And they're like, okay, yeah, that's great. But we have this issue, which is our memories are really hyperactive. They remember all of these things that we grew up learning as kids, you know, poetry that, you know, in elite Roman education meant military histories and stories about the gods. And, you know, why is it that even as monks, we still just keep seeing that stuff crop up in our minds? And how do we deal with that? And the advice they get is basically, you can't empty out your memory. That's basically impossible. But instead, you can fill it with other memories, with new memories. And the key is that you need to care as much about that stuff as you cared about the poetry you learned when you were a kid. So you need to tackle it with the same enthusiasm and same tenacity that, you know, as a kid, you just were poring over these great epic stories. And the more that you flood your mind with those kind of memories, the easier it will be when your mind is jumping around later to settle on stuff that actually it's good for it to encounter, rather than that, you know, those old stories you don't care about anymore.
Now, John Cassian also didn't like nosiness. And when I think of nosiness, I think of a couple of shows from the 60s. I don't remember whether it was I Dream a Dream of Jeannie or Bewitched, but the neighbor that was always looking out the window, paying attention to what the other neighbor was doing across the street. Yeah. And he actually saw it as a sign of mental instability, specifically a condition called acedia.
Yeah, he basically, you know, there were nosy neighbors back then, just like there were in Bewitched. It was an indication that whoever was exhibiting nosiness was had this sort of deeper problem of dissatisfaction. Like basically, if you're a nosy person, it means that you wish that your own current situation was better or more interesting or different somehow, but you have no idea how to change it. You sort of feel conflicted. You're both unhappy, but like clueless about how to take action. It's really similar to what psychologists and neuroscientists today see as like the technical meaning of boredom. Like you want things to be different, but you don't know what to do about it. And so a monk who felt this way, a monk who felt acedia, became exhibited nosiness, like just sort of because this monk couldn't decide for him or herself what they actually wanted to do, they would just go and like bother the monk next door and be like, what's going on? You know, it was for them a really technical meaning, whereas sort of earlier on, it had been more generally like you paying attention to stuff that wasn't any of your business. Like it was just a way for you to busy yourself with all the hustle and bustle without actually attending to things that you needed to do. And for Cassian, he thought, yeah, this is indicative of a more serious mental issue, which is that you're sort of stuck and need to find a way to break out of that.
So what would Cassian think about monks that were on social media all the time?
I don't think Cassian would have recommended that they have social media accounts. Although I think that I think some monks definitely would have wanted them and thought that they were appropriate. Like, you know, like it was important for some of them to be engaged sometimes. It was just a matter of like knowing when to draw the line and not getting too fixated or obsessed with it. Obsessed with communication, obsessed with sharing your opinions with other people. Cassian, though, yes, he would have hated it.
So have you learned anything new about managing distraction from all the deep research you did to write this book that you've looked at personally and said, I think I'm going to try this?
For me, the most basic thing is just being a little bit more self-aware. Self-awareness is sort of...
Don't we take that for granted? Self-awareness, we literally take that for granted, I think, often.
Yeah, I mean, I think just sort of being able to step aside for a sec and watch yourself and to say, is this what I want to be doing? That's a really powerful thing. It's really one of the most simple tools in the monk's arsenal, but also extremely useful. And I think, you know, the other thing that I have learned from them is compassion. They were really, as serious as they were about fighting distraction, they were really sympathetic about how hard it was and about, and they were realistic about how you were going to mess up. And so, you know, yeah, that's why they have all those stories to encourage each other. You need role models, but they were also candid about their own failures, even if they were experts.
I do want to talk about one more story that I can't forget. And this was of a monastery that was started in Poitiers, France.
Oh, yep.
And in essence, a class revolt. You can't have all these princes and princesses going to a monastery for women and think that they're going to be happy with being treated equally.
Yeah, this monastery in Poitiers was founded by a Merovingian queen, and she recruited several other elite and royal women to the monastery. It does seem like at this monastery, like at many others, the elite women kind of bristled at having to actually be humble in the sense of like social distinction doesn't matter. You're not entitled to anything. You need to, you know, earn your status. You need to work constantly. A lot of elites did convert to monasticism, but found in fact that it was actually very challenging. And some wanted the challenge and others didn't. And at this particular monastery, a couple of the royal recruits after the queen died revolted against the abbess, whom they saw as lower class than them. They led a group of fellow monks out of the monastery. They protested to kings. They ended up going to trial in front of the king and many bishops. They argued that the abbess had violated the monastery's rules. But actually the court found in favor of the abbess and thought that it was the princesses who were at fault. In the course of it, though, there was a lot of violence. They had, you know, recruited basically retainers or warriors to, you know, attack members of the city's police force. They tried to coerce farmers who worked for the monastery into giving them their yields and services. It was a whole mess. In the course of it, multiple nuns got pregnant. In the end, the reason this story got told was because it was meant to demonstrate how important it is to have a system of social stability within a monastic community. That, yeah, it's all fine and good if you want to work on yourself, but you also need to be attentive to what kind of power people have as a collective. And if the collective breaks down, a lot of bad things can happen. The community did work to restore order after all that happened. One of the princesses apologized and went back. One didn't. But the community banded together after that and tried to find ways to bolster their support for each other. So we have some hagiography that was written after the fact as a way of sort of saying, let's go after social cohesion again, because we can do a lot of good for each other. But yeah, it made for a very memorable story.
And this was before France was an actual kingdom. I think it was still Gaul. And this was one of the ruling lines before the Carolingians, where we all have heard of Charlemagne, right?
Exactly. Yeah. This was at the end of the 6th century. So the late 500s.
Can I call it the Holy Cross Revolt?
Yes.
Holy Cross being the name of the monastery. So talk about at what point did you see this as a book? Did your idea for this book come from the other research you had done and that idea start perking up? What was it that sort of got you going down this path to say, I want to write a book about monks and what they think about distraction?
Some of it's rooted in research that's really old, some readings that I did when I was in grad school. I was just really impressed at sort of the monks interested in cognition and just sort of their psychological savviness in general. But it wasn't until probably 4 or 5 years ago when someone had said that they were surprised to hear that monks got distracted. And I don't know. I was like, really? It's just everyone gets distracted. So it seemed like something worth pursuing. Yeah. I mean, because, and also just, I really wanted to share this literature with people because it's so endearing. It's so smart. It's so surprising. Through both this literature and this theme of distraction, it seems like a good opportunity to write this.
And we learn a lot in this book about how monks live, period. It goes far beyond distraction.
Yeah. Yeah. I was hoping it could be a kind of way to open up a world that a lot of people don't know much about. I mean, it's not just that monasticism is unfamiliar, but, you know, this period between the end of the Roman Empire in the West and the High Middle Ages, which people know more about from pop culture. I thought it would be a good chance to kind of open up late antiquity and the early Middle Ages to readers.
So what do you want your lay reader to get from this? And when I say lay reader, someone who isn't a professor or studying philosophy, just someone who picks up the book like me and said, I'm overly distracted. Let me see what Jamie has to say. What do you want the lay reader to get from this?
Well, one thing is just, you know, I think it's really useful to think about the monk's model of the mind as being embedded in a lot of different relationships. And so if we want to improve our concentration, it requires lots of different strategies simultaneously, thinking about our schedules, our, you know, working environments, our both our coworkers and our families, thinking about what we read, what our relationship to our technology is, how we engage with our memories, what kind of metacognitive work we do. All that stuff matters. So that's one thing. And then I guess the other would be just basically a sense of how sophisticated and interesting this period is, even though it's often called the Dark Ages. This was a time of intense experimentation and energy and some really very smart people.
Late antiquity is also called the Dark Ages, but you chose to refer to it as late antiquity. I'm not a historian, so help me with that.
It's the early Middle Ages that's usually referred to as the Dark Ages. Okay. Late antiquity, because it coincides with the late Roman Empire, doesn't usually have that reputation as much. But yeah, I mean, basically these centuries between roughly 450 to 800 or 900 used to be seen as the Dark Ages, but historians don't like that very much.
The question I actually had very early, I never got to, was to give our audience a sense of what was it like living during that time period? What was going on in the world? Because when all the references, I'm looking them up, there's no France.
Yeah.
There's no England. There's no Germany. Where the Roman Empire, I guess, is still going on. We got the Eastern and the Western Roman Empire, because this is before the fall of Constantinople, which wasn't until, I guess, the 1500s. So what was going on historically to give listeners or readers some sort of context at that time?
Yeah, so you've got the Roman Empire, which in the course of the 5th century basically dissolves in its western half. So basically North Africa and Europe and England. And in its stead, you have smaller political units that are experimenting with different kinds of government as an alternative to caring about the emperor and Constantinople. But meanwhile, the Roman Empire continues in its eastern half, up to Mesopotamia, basically, and with some wars with the Sasanian government in Persia. And then in the 7th century, you get the rise of the caliphate. The Umayyads gradually sort of conquer all of Mesopotamia, the Levant, Egypt, North Africa, up to Spain, the Iranian plateau. So politically, there's a lot that's changing. Sort of one significant development that you see in Europe as all of that is happening is a sort of formation of political units that is interested in exploring ethnic identity as a component of governance. So this is the first time you start to hear of the Franks, for example, or the Visigoths. Eventually you see some of these identities coalesce and even, give names to these later kingdoms. So France eventually, in the High Middle Ages, its name stems all the way back to these Franci, like a term of political belonging in Gaul and Francia. So yeah, there's a lot of really interesting political and religious experimentation in these centuries.
And you mentioned Mesopotamia. Is that sort of Iraq, Iran, part of the Middle East?
Yeah. So that area is, a kind of borderland between the Roman and Persian governments, and then it becomes part of the caliphate. It's predominantly Christian for throughout the early Middle Ages, but you see lots of different Christianities in that region, in the Eastern Mediterranean and Mesopotamia, because there's Chalcedonian Christianity based in the Byzantine capital of Constantinople, but very many different kinds of Christianities that are more or less opposed to Chalcedonian Christianity. That's where also the Syriac language was thriving in these centuries, and then later Arabic. So, one interesting thing is that, despite all of these, this political differentiation, despite all of these different religious identities, it's sort of striking how monasticism, despite being really variegated, is also kind of defined by some common preoccupations, like how do we concentrate on God? Like, what are the practices and mindsets that make the most sense for us? So that's another really interesting part of this history, I think, is that even with all of this diversity, you also do have some common threads that bind monastic culture together.
Well, Jamie Kreiner, author of The Wandering Mind, What Medieval Monks Tell Us About Distraction. And I am proud to share with you that I was not distracted one time during our interview. This is an absolutely fascinating book. Thank you so much for being a guest on Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thanks so much, Hopeton. It was good to be here.
Thank you for listening to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay, host and producer. The theme music is provided by Wright Productions. You can follow the show on social media. Under Facebook and Instagram, it's Diverse Voices Book Review, or Twitter under @DiverseBooksHay.